William Wilberforce and the campaign to end slavery. Very relevant in our days, because not only is slavery making a massive comeback, but there are other social evils that need to be fought these days. The slave trade in the early 19th century presented a monumental ethical challenge and an apparently insurmountable obstacle to missionary outreaches in Africa. The abolition of the slave trade helped prepare the way for the 19th century to become the greatest century for missionary advance. As we battle against great social evils such as abortion, which we will be fighting this very Sunday with the Life Chain, and pornography, and persecution, and as we strive to work for reformation, the overwhelming opposition, the pressure can drive one to exhaustion and a temptation to give up the fight. And sadly, a lot of Christians suffer burnout and give up the fight before the fight has been won. But I think we've been encouraged by seeing how friends in America, after 50 years, have seen Roe v. Wade reversed, and now they can actually see abortion roll back state by state. William Wilberforce, the reformer who led the campaign to abolish the slave trade and to set those in bondage free, was persistently slandered in the media, threatened, physically assaulted, even the target of attempted murder because of a social stance. Yet, William Wilberforce persevered, and after a lifetime crusade, his steadfastness was rewarded with the liberation of all slaves throughout the British Empire, particularly affecting those in Jamaica. At this critical stage in history, Christians need to learn from one of the greatest Christian statesmen and how, in the face of constant derision and opposition, he succeeded in abolishing not just the slave trade, but slavery itself, in fact. Now, it's a historic fact that all nations, all tribes engaged in slavery, particularly the Muslim nations. They've been at it for 1,400 years, and the main place you'll find the world today, slavery still existing, are in Muslim Middle Eastern countries. However, it was the Emperor Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire, the very same emperor before whom Martin Luther made this historic, "My conscience is captive, the word of God, here I stand, I cannot do otherwise." That emperor, he's the one who first got Europe involved in the slave trade. 1519, just a couple of years before Martin Luther confronted him. Now, because of Pope Alexander VI's line of demarcation bill of 1493, it barred Spain from Africa. Africa was for Portugal. Spain got South America. But the way he drew the line, they didn't know that there was a bump of South America sticking out, which today is Brazil. And so the Portuguese managed to get a slice of the New World as well, just because the line of demarcation hadn't anticipated there would be something in South America that would go to the east of that. So Spain offered asientos, or monopoly, to other nations to supply slaves for their South American colonies. Spain was not allowed to be working in Africa, and Portugal wasn't allowed to be working in the New World. So that's why Spain had to get other countries to transport slaves there. First, Portugal had this lucrative franchise, but because the Spanish were most competitive with the Portuguese, they soon gave it to the Dutch and then to the French. And finally, by the Treaty of Utrecht, 1713, the asientos, or the monopoly, was transferred from France to Britain. Initially, the contract was for 4,800 slaves a year, but during the next century, in other words, we're talking about the 18th century, Britain transported up to 2 million slaves to the New World. Britain's involvement in slavery was first authorized by Charles I in 1631. Now, it's the same Charles I who Oliver Cromwell in Parliament would fight and later put on trial and have executed for treason. A bit disturbing that today we've got a Charles III. I don't know why anyone would want to name a King of England Charles, because the first two Charleses were catastrophically disastrous. Now, Oliver Cromwell Pond obviously abolished British involvement in the slave trade, but Charles II, at the Restoration, reintroduced slavery or the slave trade by a royal charter. It's interesting to note it's the enemies of the Reformation that got Europe involved in the slave trade. The trade, as it became known, just like when it comes to abortion, I speak about the procedure. It's a nice neutral term that manages to cover a multitude of sins. like the Americans, we call it collateral damage when they kill civilians. Slave ships sailed from Bristol or Liverpool, loaded with cloths and beads and muskets and iron bars and brandy, and this merchandise was then traded in West Africa in exchange for slaves. They could see textiles, brandy, and arms go to Africa, slaves go to the Americas, and sugar, coffee, and tobacco go back to Europe. Now, many African chiefs sold their own people, others engaged in wars and slave raids. So slavery was practiced for everyone. It's not that Europeans were running around Africa throwing nets over people and capturing people. No, they were being captured by chiefs and sold. They might have been criminals. This is cheaper to sell them than to execute them or something, a way of income. They might have captured neighboring tribes. So chiefs might have sold their own people or engaged in wars and slave trades in order to capture victims for the trade. But often professional Arab slave traders provided the victims. But they were generally at the coast, and they would have others who would be doing the raids into the interior to bring them to the coast. Then there's the Middle Passage. The Middle Passage, that's a passage from Africa to South America or Central America. They would transport the slaves mainly to the West Indies. Here the slaves were sold and the ships were loaded with spices, rum, molasses, and sugar. And the third leg of the journey was the return to England, and ultimately 160 British ships were involved in slaving, including captained by one man whose song we just sung, Amazing Grace. John Newton was not just a sailor and a slave trader and a captain of a slave vessel, but even became a slave to slaves or servant to slaves through pretty poor luck and bad health. He ended up actually being horribly treated, abused by slaves, where he was literally treated as a slave in West Africa, and a horrible experience which ultimately brought him to the Lord. These are the areas where slave trading was being done from and where they were going to. And so these are the main slave ports that you could see throughout Africa, and a lot were actually coming from what today we know as Ghana and Nigeria. Photographs of people in the 19th century chained up by Muslim slave traders. But of course, that's only a small fraction of the slave trade. Most of the slaves were sent over North Africa or across Central Africa or up the east coast of Africa. The Indian Ocean, Red Sea, and Sahara, North African slave trade, dwarfed it by a factor of 10, the slave trade across to the Americas. God called a man named William Wilberforce to fight this evil. The average Englishman on the street was kept in the dark as to what was actually happening on the Middle Passage. They just knew we're selling a lot of things to Africa and getting a lot of fun things back from the West Indies. And, you know, what a deal. But they didn't see the slaves, so it didn't affect the average person until in 1785, Thomas Clarkson's landmark study was published, Slavery and the Commerce in the Human Species. This was published first in Latin, and just the average person in university knew Latin. In fact, entrance qualifications to universities in those days was you had to be able to debate in the Latin. Entrance qualifications. And so he later had it translated in English and was very widely circulated. And was focusing on what was then called the Grain Coast, Ivory Coast, the Gold Coast, and the Slave Coast. In 1787, William Wilberforce wore out the pages of his copy of Clarkson's book on slavery. It was a revelation. According to Clarkson's research, 10% of slaves had normally died during the Middle Passage. Strong men could fetch as much as 40 pounds. That's an astronomical amount of money. That could be a person's annual income, by the way, at that time. While women and children were sold in cheap batches with the sick and the weak men. The fit were often branded with silver branding irons to minimize infection so that they could know who belonged to who. Slaving was one of the largest and certainly the most profitable sectors of the British economy. In England, 18,000 people were employed simply on making the goods to trade for slaves. The trade constituted 4.4% of British exports. A lot of vested economic interests. On Sunday, the 28th of October, 1787, Wilberforce wrote in his diary, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of society, or manners, as they described then. William Wilberforce was born in 1759 into a wealthy family and educated at Cambridge. He was elected to Parliament in 1780 at the age of 21. He served in the House of Commons for the next 45 years. William was short and frail. He was only 5 foot. He was frail, frequently sick. He was afflicted with poor eyesight. But he more than made up for this weak body with his vigorous mind and boundless energy. And he's a particularly gifted speaker. He is generous to friends, he is generous to strangers alike, and as a child he'd been strongly influenced by the dedicated faith of his uncle and aunt. And William's father died when he was 9, so he was sent to live with William and Hannah Wilberforce, who were childless. Now, William's uncle and aunt were friends of George Whitfield, and William later described how deeply he had been impressed by Whitfield's preaching and visits to his uncle's home. He also met with John Newton, who's him we just sung, Amazing Grace. Here's the former slave ship captain who had been converted and wrote the hymn that is world-renowned and particularly sung to bagpipes. When William's mother realized that her son was becoming too religious, she came and brought him back and placed him in a boarding school and encouraged a more worldly lifestyle. I mean, what mothers want their children to be more worldly? Shocking, but evidently did not want her son to be a religious fanatic. As a member of Parliament, Wilberforce opposed the British war against the American colonies, declaring that the British cabinet ministers were acting more like lunatics than statesmen, and denounced their cruel, bloody, and impractical policies. And Wilberforce soon made his name with his quick wit and devastating sarcasm. Now, this is a very dangerous position to have taken in the 1700s, when you could lose your head for supporting the enemies of the state. But he said, this is just wrong. And, of course, they saw the people in America as Englishmen living in North America who were having the same rights and should have been under the protection of Magna Carta. And why were they being taxed so heavily, oppressed, not having representation? And so Wilberforce was more than sympathetic. He is openly supportive of the American cause. In 1783, Wilberforce traveled to France and he met with King Louis XVI and with Marie Antoinette. He was impressed with Marie Antoinette's intelligence, but not so much with Louis XVI. He met with Lafayette, the famous French general who helped the Americans fight the British in the War of Independence, and Benjamin Franklin, who was a wonder of the age, great inventor, writer, and philosopher. Now, his good friend William Pitt was then elected Prime Minister at age 24, the youngest British Prime Minister in history. 24 years old, he's Prime Minister of the greatest country in the world at that time. Wilberforce then stood for Yorkshire, the largest county in England, and he won by a landslide. And this was a powerful, probably the most powerful seat in all of England. And so there was this alliance between Wilberforce and William Pitt that made them unassailable. It was at this point, when he won such an unassailable position in politics and society, that Wilberforce was confronted with the claims of the gospel of Christ through a book, The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul by Philip Doddridge. Now, he had gone, because he's ill, on a holiday to France and had chosen a traveling companion who could be intellectually stimulating. And this friend said, let us direct our conversations by following the theme of a book. Fair enough. And this friend chose this book, The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. And so they would read and they'd discuss it chapter by chapter. Throughout the whole day. What an interesting way of directing constructively conversations. I was told by Bill Batman when he went to Le Brie, it was always a stipulation by Francis Schaeffer that all conversation at dinner table had to be about a certain theme each day. So, for example, say it was lunch or supper on the Monday, he'd say, tonight we will be discussing art in the early Renaissance period, or we will be discussing Michelangelo, or we'll be discussing tonight economics, or whatever it would be. He would choose a theme, and all conversation had to be around that subject or theme. And Bill Bethan said just how it was so incredible to have directed conversations like that. Of course, Le Brie was something like a think tank like that, but how many people go on holiday with the idea to challenge your friends or family on a spiritual theme? Now, his mind was convinced of the truth of the gospel, but he recognized that intellectual assent was not enough. It's not enough to know it in your head. A sharp conflict raged with him. I'm no Christian, he admitted. He was overcome with anguish. The deep guilt and dark ingratitude of my past life forced itself on me in the strongest colors. And I condemned myself for having wasted precious time and opportunities and talents. He was appalled by his shapeless idleness, his sense of great sinfulness in having so long neglected the unspeakable mercies of my God and Savior, especially as he knew it early on in his life from his uncle and aunt and from John Newton himself. He knew the truth of the gospel, but he had not surrendered to it. And unfortunately, a lot of people today equate knowledge of the truth with the truth. But it's not enough to know all the doctrines of the truth of the gospel and have it in a deep freeze or on a shelf. It's got to be on fire in our heart, in our life. Through all his heart searching and Bible study and prayer, he was transformed. Now that's a productive holiday. Since nearly all politicians drank and gambled and engaged in corrupt practices, William assumed that he would now have to give up his political career. So in turmoil, he went to see his boyhood hero, Reverend John Newton, the old slave trader. Should he give up politics and become a preacher? Or should he seclude himself from society and live a life of quiet meditation prayer? He assumed there's no way I can be a Christian and a politician. Everyone in politics is about as corrupt as anything. In response, John Newton admonished him that to leave his post in Parliament would be desertion from the duty to which God had called him. It is hoped and believed that the Lord has raised you up for the good of his church and for the good of the nation. He would have opportunities others could not even dream of. If he stayed in politics, he could find opportunities to advance God's kingdom that other people could only dream of. What an opportunity he had. He was young, he was in his early 20s, and he had an opportunity to influence the politics of Britain. Wilberforce now informed his good friend, the Prime Minister, that he could no longer vote the party line if it conflicted with his Christian principles. The change in his behavior and politics was dramatic. He resigned from 5 clubs in one day. He used to gamble a lot. He gambled and drank excessively before his conversion. Now that had to stop. He stopped going to plays and theatres, which had become particularly decadent at that time. He gave up gambling. With a new intellectual rigour, he set himself to redeem his idle years. He became less temperamental, more stable, more cheerful. He saw clearly that if a man became a Christian, it should influence everything he thinks and everything he does. He began to search the scriptures for the principles upon which his politics needs to be based. And as he explained to one constituent, we are to give an account of our political conduct at the judgment seat of Christ. Oh, if we had more politicians who thought like that. At his conversion, there were only 2 other evangelical members of Parliament. 2. By the time of his death, there were over 100 evangelical members in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. That's just an unbelievable exponential improvement. It just shows you, some people say, well, what difference can one person make? Well, if the one person evangelizes and disciples, he can multiply himself. And if that person is evangelized and disciples will evangelize and disciple someone else, they'll multiply. And that's the concept of evangelical explosion. The whole church, taking the whole gospel to the whole world. Don't add to the church and multiply. Make sure the people who went to Christ are evangelized. In fact, the evangelist's job is not complete until the evangelized are evangelizing. The discipler's job is not complete until the disciple is discipling. A parent's task is not complete until their children become a parent. It's another way of thinking. One of the Wilberforce's first actions as a Christian was to persuade the king, that's George III, to issue a proclamation calling for the spiritual reformation throughout the land. And so on the 1st of June, 1787, the king, King George III, gazetted a proclamation for the encouragement of the piety and virtue and for the preventing of vice, profaneness, and immorality. I think we could all do with a bill like that. It declared, whereas we cannot but observe with inexpressible concern the rapid progress of impiety and licentiousness, and the deluge of profaneness, immorality, and every kind of vice, do hereby declare our royal purpose and resolution to discountenance and punish all manner of vice, profaneness, and immorality. Church attendance was urged. Sheriffs and justices were to be very vigilant and strict in prosecuting those guilty of excessive drinking, blasphemy, profane swearing, cursing, lewdness, and other immoral and dissolute practices. They were also ordered to close down brothels, destroy all loose and licentious prints, books, and publications dispersing poison in the minds of the young, and to punish the publishers and vendors, or salesmen thereof. The Secretary of State was instructed to send 6 copies of this proclamation to the High Sheriff of every county, with the King's command it be publicly read and acted upon. At the time, very few realized that the member for Yorkshire, William Wilberforce, was the author of this proclamation sent out in King George III's name. Wilberforce then established a proclamation society to ensure that the proclamation became a force, not a farce. Local chapters of the society worked to bring about reformation at every level of society. The time was ripe. Many thousands whose lives had been transformed by the preaching of George Whitefield and John Wesley got involved in a campaign to clean up and reshape the nation. Magistrates throughout the nation eagerly responded to the proclamation. The seriousness of the crime wave provoked a groundswell of popular support for Wilberforce's campaign. As Wilberforce wrote, surely the principles as well as the practice of Christianity are simple, and they lead to action. I had a bishop once ask me, why do you have the word action in the name of Africa Christian Action? I said, because we're Africans, we're Christian, and we're committed to action. I can remember somebody asking, why do you have a sword in your badge? And I said, the sword represents the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. Africa, the Bible, sword. And I was asked this question in Switzerland, and I said, for the same reason that Ulrich Zwingli's monument down the road has a hulking great big sword in his hands. And I'm like, oh, the chap actually had to walk to the window and look out. There was Zwingli's statue, and like he had never noticed. He's standing with his massive double-handed sword and big Bible, and he had missed the sword. Christianity leads to action. William Wilberforce also wrote a book which had an enormous impact on the upper class of Britain. This is the full title, A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians in the Higher and Middle Classes of this country contrasted with real Christianity. We normally summarize it down to real Christianity or practical Christianity. They used to have long titles, not snappy ones, but you certainly understood what it meant. In 6 months, it went through 5 editions, sold 7,500 copies. If you understand the old printing press system where each page is done separately, unlike our it isn't like our machines can do a few thousand an hour. This is a very serious amount of sales in such a short time. By 1826, 15 editions had been published in England and 25 editions had been published in America. It had also been translated into French, Italian, Spanish, Dutch, and German. David Livingstone, the missionary who pioneered Christianity throughout the hinterland of Africa and successfully campaigned to eradicate the Islamic slave trade, testified that Wilberforce's book, Real Christianity, was one of the most important formative books he ever read, which galvanized and directed his whole life. In Parliament, Wilberforce generally voted against the expenditure of money. If the government wanted you to vote for money for something, he was generally no. Although it was the government which needed to free the slaves because it was the government that was protecting the slave trade, Wilberforce knew the government could not do everything. In fact, it should not exceed its jurisdiction. The Bible clearly limits the authority of the state to the ministries of defense, law and order, and justice. That's it. Defense, punishment, prosecution, that's it. It's not meant to get involved in health, education, so on. Leave that in the hands of the community and the private sector, the church, and so on. For this reason, Wilberforce did not support the expansion of government powers. He did not support increased taxation. The state is a minister of justice. The church is the minister of grace, as depicted here. The Palace of Westminster, or the House of Parliament, House of Lords, is on one side of the road, and the other side is Westminster Abbey. And they are mutually to be supportive. Churches to speak to the state and pray for the state, and the state to protect the church, but they are separately under God. Minister of Justice, Minister of Grace. He did much to help the poor and the needy personally and voluntarily through voluntary societies. In some years, he gave more to charity than his entire income. So not surprisingly, William Wilberforce ended his life bankrupt and living in one of his children's homes because he had literally lost his own home, everything. He had poured everything into his charities. In 1802, the Proclamation Society was replaced by the Society for the Suppression of Vice. Amongst the many inspired to Reformation principles by this society was Lord Shaftesbury, who began his campaign to outlaw child labour in factories the very year that Wilberforce died. And Princess Victoria, who was destined to be Britain's longest reigning queen to that date. Princess Victoria was part of Wilberforce's Society for the Prevention and Suppression of Vice. In 1803, Wilberforce also helped to form the British and Foreign Bible Society, which was the first interdenominational society uniting Anglicans and dissenters. Dissenters being, you know, part of the state church, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterians, others, Quakers. He also supported Hannah More's pioneering of the first Sunday schools and helped launch the Church Missionary Society, that was the Anglican Missionary Society in 1798, and he started the Society for the Betterment of the Condition of the Poor in 1796. He sent missionaries to Tahiti and regularly supported William Carey's Baptist Mission India. So although he is an Anglican, he had no problem supporting Baptist missions in the field. As one person described Wilberforce, factories did not spring up more rapidly in Leeds and Manchester than schemes of benevolence beneath his roof. Wilberforce's home became a kind of national center of benevolence and moral reform. At one time, he is president, vice president, or member of the committee for 69 societies. And he managed all this while being married, and his wife and him had four sons and two daughters. Also remarkable is the fact that unlike most men of Wilberforce's day and his class, he spent quality time playing and praying with his children, which generally speaking, the men did not do at that time. He declared, "The spiritual interest of my children is my first priority." So all attended family prayers, which were held while kneeling twice a day. These times of devotions were described as short and cheerful. Wilberforce urged his fellow members of Parliament to curtail their activities on Sunday, if not to honour the Lord's Day, at least for the sake of the servants, that the servants could get a rest and honour the Lord's Day. William himself set the example. He attended both services every Sunday at his church. He would only travel or discuss politics on Lord's Day in the gravest emergency. Professor Henry Perkins, in The Origins of Modern English Society of 1968, states, between 1780 and 1850, the English ceased to be one of the most aggressive, brutal, rowdy, outspoken, riotous, cruel, and bloodthirsty nations in the world, and became one of the most inhibited, polite, orderly, tender-minded, prudish, and hypocritical. A secular person's perspective, but obviously something dramatically changed. And it was the evangelical revival. However, it was the campaign to abolish slavery that dominated most of Wilberforce's life and demanded most of his life and energy, ending the slave trade, setting the captives free. Captain Sir Charles Middleton, while in the Navy, had boarded a French slave ship in the West Indies and was horrified by what he saw. He wrote to Wilberforce requesting him to raise the matter in Parliament, and Wilberforce replied he felt unequal to the task but could not possibly decline. In discussing this with his friend, the Prime Minister, William Pitt, Pitt declared, "Wilberforce, England needs a crusader to wake her up. The slave trade is horrible business. It will be a long, hard fight, but someone must take the lead. William, you are that man." And he commented that William Wilberforce was the most intelligent, articulate, and eloquent person in public speaking, the most humorous public speaker. "You're the right person for the job." Now, John Newton also encouraged Wilberforce to launch this crusade against slavery. The example of Christ inspired him. "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, release for the prisoners." So Isaiah 61 verse 1 became a major theme of this movement. Now, realizing that he was going to war against an extremely profitable business with deeply entrenched financial interest and with a lot of serious political support, Wilberforce prepared his campaign carefully. He gathered around himself a group of researchers and assistants dedicated to eradicating slavery. First of all, most senior of them all, Granville Sharpe, who in 1772 had initiated a lawsuit which successfully established the principle based on the common law of England that as soon as any slave set foot in Britain, he became free. Now the song, Britons never, never, never will be slaves, and the whole principle was, you come to Britain with your slave is automatically set free. There can be no slave in the British Isles. And that was already established in 1772. Thomas Clarkson, the author of Slavery and Commerce in the Human Species, he of course was part of Wilberforce Group, and then Zachary Macaulay, who himself had once been a slave plantation manager before his conversion, and others that he recruited, they were tireless, innovative, experienced in strengthening this campaign. But a debilitating illness delayed William. Finally, 12th of May, 1789, he introduced a bill for the abolition of the slave trade. I mean not to accuse anyone, but to take the shame upon myself, in common deeds with the whole Parliament of Britain, for having suffered this horrid trade to be carried out under their authority. We are all guilty. We ought all to plead guilty and not to exculpate ourselves by throwing the blame on others. He spoke for 3.5 hours. He moved 12 resolutions against the slave trade. Reports described as one of the most gripping, moving speeches ever delivered in Parliament. It would have to be to carry out for 3.5 hours. Pitt declared that Wilberforce was the greatest natural eloquence of all the men I ever knew. Most of the House was convinced of the righteousness of Wilberforce's arguments, but they were fearful that abolition could result in an economic disaster. So the House accepted a delaying tactic proposed by the planters, that's the plantation owners, and the slavers, that they be granted leave to produce evidence in reply. The matter was deferred until next session, and here you can see the devil's hands and things. Tragically, the French Revolution erupted before the next session. The tide of public opinion now hardened against abolition in reaction to the anarchy and mass murder across the Channel in France. And when evidence on behalf of the trade was concluded in April 1790, the slavers tried to get a snap decision before the evidence against slavery could be heard. Wilberforce needed to promptly mobilize his forces to win the right to continue. A general election in June 1790 interrupted the proceedings. The deteriorating situation in France and a bloody revolt by slaves in Saint-Domingue was exploited by the planters, who attributed these revolutions to Wilberforce's abolitionist campaign. It's all his fault. On the 18th of April 1791, the House debated Wilberforce's bill until 3:30 in the morning. The vote ended in defeat for the abolitionists by 163 votes to 88. In the light of this reversal, Wilberforce began a regular strategy meeting for his co-workers and allies in a library in Clapham. The Clapham community, which the enemies called the Clapham cult, it was no cult at all, it was very standard Orthodox Christian believers, but the Clapham community recognized that this campaign could well require a lifetime to win. They were right. These meetings were often bathed in prayer, and out of these strategy sessions came the idea of outflanking the corrupt puppets of the West Indian interest in Parliament by creating a groundswell of popular support for the abolition of slavery. Many thousands, ultimately millions of pamphlets like these were printed and distributed. Clarkson produced a shocking drawing of how slaves were packed like sardines into slave ships for the Middle Passage. This is one of the prints produced at that time, showing how the people were positioned on the top deck and the lower deck, and then positioning and showing how this works out in stacks and just unbelievably inhumane conditions. They also produced this artwork, Am I Not a Man and a Brother? The print was mass-produced, widely circulated, and public meetings and rallies were organized worldwide. A boycott of slave-grown sugar was supported by over 300,000 people, including people like William Carey. Sugar was produced using slaves in Jamaica and so on, and so they boycotted sugar. That's quite a serious boycott. And if only people today would boycott goods made by slave labor in China, for example. 517 petitions for abolition were delivered to Parliament, and only 4 petitions against. In 1792, with slave revolts in Haiti and threatened revolts in British Jamaica, where slaves outnumbered the colonists 16 to 1, and war with France looming, public reticence and panic swayed the debate. the best Wilberforce could achieve was a resolution to gradually abolish the slave trade by 1796. This was passed by 230-85 in the House of Commons, but the bill became bogged down and sank beneath the surface in the House of Lords, which is what they planned. The fact that George III went insane about this time, and that Britain lost just about all their colonies in America, did not help matters either. Wilberforce pledged to introduce a new bill to abolish the slave trade every year until it succeeded, and he did just that. The last letter ever written by John Wesley was a fairly pessimistic message to Wilberforce. "I see not how you can go through with your glorious enterprise in opposing that execrable villainy, which is the scandal of religion, of England, and of human nature. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn down by the opposition of men and devils." And here's the letter, not very positive and encouraging, but nevertheless certainly fair and accurate. Indeed, Wilberforce was becoming one of the most hated men in England. On different occasions, his life was physically threatened by West Indian sea captains. National hero, Admiral Lord Nelson, Thomas Nelson, wrote from his flagship Victory to condemn the damnable doctrine of Wilberforce and his hypocritical allies. I mean, this is one of the greatest war heroes in British history, and he was against Wilberforce too. Admiral Lord Rodney declared he had never known any slave to be ill-treated in the West Indies. Knowing human nature, that's frankly unbelievable. Lord Heathfield, the defender of Gibraltar, commented that a slave on the way to the Indies had twice as much cubic airspace as a British soldier in a regulation tent. Well, that may be so, but a regulation army tent is outside, not crammed in the middle of a ship's hull on the lowest level. Admiral Lord St. Vincent declared the whole of society would go to pieces if Wilberforce's abolition bill went through. I mean, you listen to some people today about bills abolishing abortion. But, you know, the streets would be swelled with unwanted street children. So, well, we've got all that now anyway with abortion, so I don't know what they're complaining about. The Duke of Clarence asserted that the House of Lords, that the promoters of abolition were either frauds or hypocrites. Okay, so either fraud or hypocrite. There are only two options here, apparently. Every disturbance or revolt in the West Indies was blamed on Wilberforce. Lady Malmesbury in 1791 insisted on Wilberforce being tried for murder and executed because of some murders committed by slaves. Third degree guilt. Langford Hodge accused Wilberforce of having created a volcano, like the entire French Revolution was his fault. Scurrilous smear campaigns targeted Wilberforce. While he's still a bachelor, he was accused of being a wife beater, and his wife was a black. And he's a wife beater. So, you know, he's a total hypocrite. Others accused him of being a Republican and a revolutionary, which in a monarchy like Britain, those are two of the worst things. It's like calling a person, well, I don't know if calling a person a communist is a problem anymore, like calling him a Nazi. Homophobic bigots, racist or something. You know, that's the equivalent at that time. All abolitionists are Jacobins. Jacobins were the most radical group of French revolutionaries, by the way. So Lord Abington called him a Jacobin. King George III now declared that Wilberforce and his allies were hypocrites and not to be trusted. Mind you, the king wasn't sane at this time, so it's not too serious. Other printed attacks on Wilberforce included totally ignorant on the subject of slavery, the most consummate hypocrite of favouring fat, lazy Negro slaves who were laughing from morning till night over his own country. Wyndham called him a wicked little fanatical imp. I mean, these are just some of the quotes. How did Wilberforce manage to persevere in the face of such sustained hatred and character assassination? He established and maintained a lifetime of daily discipline. He knew the value of the first few hours of the day for Bible study, prayer, and mental preparation for the day. He sought to discipline his tongue, his tastes, and his thoughts. He surrendered his reputation to God early on, and he commented after a slanderous article published in the Courier that such attacks are like the barking of dogs as you pass through a village. You don't stop just because the dogs bark at you. He preferred criticism to flattery, and he praised God that he had freedom from the fear of men's opinions. You're not going to achieve much if you care about what people say about you. He did all that he could, and then he left the results in God's hands. Duty is ours, the consequences are God's. His faith was resilient because his faith was not in himself or his talents. His faith was in God alone, Wilberforce believed that God was sovereign. God is sovereign. And he guides and overrules in men's lives down to the smallest details. God could put his thoughts in our minds. William once asked a pastor if he believed in God's specific guidance. Yes, said the clergyman, on great occasions. As unphilosophical as unscriptural, responded Wilberforce. Must not the smallest links be as necessary for the maintaining of the continuity as the greatest? There is no great or little to God. He is adamant. God intervened and was sovereign in both national matters and personal matters. Wilberforce was so crystal clear about his principles, so free of worry about himself, that he is free to think of others. Another reason for Wilberforce's astonishing resilience and persistence in his campaigns is he never worked alone. He was supported by a community of dedicated, hard-working activists. In order to accommodate freed slaves, the Clapham community of Wilberforce founded a settlement in Sierra Leone in 1787. How advanced is that? They poured vast investments into this venture through the Sierra Leone Company as a form of restitution for England's role in the slave trade. People talk about restitution. Well, that was already being paid back over 200 years ago. Initially, this venture was plagued with disasters and a series of revolts and a devastating raid by French naval squadron in 1794, which just about burned everything down. By the time that Zachary Macaulay, the first governor, finally returned to England in 1799, the capital Freetown was a thriving community of 1,200 people, 300 houses, three wharves to facilitate foreign trade. Sierra Leone was an important project for the abolitionists because it demonstrated that relations between England and West Africa could be healthy and could involve legitimate commerce. It also showed that freed slaves could hold down responsible positions and that Africa had products for trade other than human flesh. The day that the slave trade was abolished in 1807, the company handed Sierra Leone over to the crown, because now they could trust the crown because the crown was no longer committed to slavery. While fighting against slavery abroad, Wilberforce was also intensely involved in reform at home. As early as 1786, he began introducing bills to reform the criminal law. He opposed flogging, whipping, and the army, which was pretty standard. Whatever you did wrong, could even be looking wrong at someone who could be flogged, both on board ship and in the army. Sought to improve prison conditions, investigate working conditions and dangers in the coal mines, and was the first to campaign against abuses of child labour in the cotton mills. This is long before Charles Dickens had even been born. He also pioneered popular education and campaigned against the gang laws, poacher. However, it was Britain's global responsibilities that preoccupied most of William Wilberforce's energies. And this is a great painting in Switzerland in the Palace of Justice entitled Justice Lifts the Nations, where Lady Justice holds the scales of justice with eyes wide open and a double-handed sword pointed down to an open Bible. And the leaders of the city look to Lady Justice for the principles of law, and she points to the scales of evidence and points to the Word of God. He organized intervention on behalf of the victims of the Napoleonic Wars, the Greeks who were fighting for their freedom from the Ottoman Empire, the North American Indians, the Haitians, and even the Hottentots in the Cape. He had campaigns for them all. One of his most important campaigns was to work for a new sense of Christian responsibility in Britain's policies for India. The prevailing view was that Britain's relations with India were purely commercial. The British East India Company's handbook of 1810 devoted 48 pages to the subject of mistresses, their upkeep, cosmetics and ornaments. The company felt no responsible for education or ethics, though. By an act of British Parliament, missionaries were forbidden to operate in India. The British missionary pioneer William Wilberforce, William Carey, had been forced to seek sanctuary in the Danish enclave of Serampore, Danish colony of Serampore, in order to carry out his illegal missionary work in British-controlled India, where missionary work was completely illegal for the first 20 years of William Wilberforce's ministry there. From 1793, Wilberforce began proposing resolutions to Parliament to authorize chaplains and missionaries and school teachers to serve in India. He brought to Parliament's attention William Carey's research exposing the prevalent Hindu practice of widow burn and infanticide and human sacrifice and the horrors of the caste system. Yet the British government refused to intervene because these practices had religious sanction. that did not want to upset the commercial dealings with the Hindus. Wilberforce declared that the exclusion of Christ's ambassadors from British India was, next to the slave trade, the foulest blot on the moral character of our country. Describing the terrible poverty, degradation, disdain for relieving human suffering and human rights abuse in India, he exclaimed, "The remedy, sir, is Christianity. Christianity assumes a true character when she takes under protection those poor, degraded beings on whom philosophy looks down with disdain, or condescension perhaps, with contemptuous condescension. Christianity delights to instruct the ignorant, to succor the needy, to comfort the sorrowful, to visit the forsaken." When challenged that he is forcing his views on the Indians, he responded, "Compulsion and Christianity? Why, the very terms of various ideas are incompatible. Christianity is the law of liberty." He was not asking Parliament to organize religion and evangelism. He's just asking him to permit it. Since the East India Company had been given a monopoly by Parliament, it was up to Parliament to ensure that they practiced religious freedom in India, just as they'd expect religious freedom in England. In 1806, William wrote, "Next to the slave trade, I've long thought I'm making no effort to introduce the blessings of religion and moral improvement amongst our subjects in the East, the greatest of our national crimes. We have too many who seem to think our dominions are safe under Brahma and Vishnu than under that of the Almighty." Wilberforce fought for a new charter that would permit the activities of all missions, whether ordained or lay preacher, whether of the established Church of England or of dissenters like William Carey. Wilberforce's campaign was supported by 1,837 petitions with 500,000 signatures. A phenomenal organization involved here, a lot of dedication. Ultimately, Wilberforce succeeded. In 1813, Parliament passed a new charter for the East India Company, guaranteeing liberty for the propagation of the Christian faith. This was a watershed in British relations with India, marking the change from looting to paternalism. I know that paternalism is a bit of a swear word these days, politically incorrect, but paternalism means fatherly. I mean, that used to be a positive term. But surely it's better than looting. As a result of the evangelical influence in British society and Parliament, Britain started to approach the native race in African Asia with a completely different goal from any other country. For administrative justice, kindness, and moderation, not merely of increasing the security of the subjects and the prosperity of the country, but of advancing social happiness and ameliorating the moral state of men and of extending a superior light. Those became national policies. Also, in 1828, Lord Bentinck, the Governor General of India, outlawed thuggee, or assassination for religious purposes. We get the term thugs from the professional assassins who had religious sanction, worshipped Kali, and who murdered people as part of religious rituals. And so, you know, when you speak about a thug, I mean, that's where the term thug comes from India. And suti, the burning alive of widows on their husband's funeral piles, and female infanticide, where, oh, it's a baby girl, toss it to the crocodiles, bury it or strangle it or something like this. That was done legally in India before. In 1807, 20 years after he first began his crusade, in the middle of Britain's war with France, Wilberforce and his team's labors were rewarded with victory. 20 years. At 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock in the morning. What are you normally doing at 4 in the morning? On the 4th of February, the Abolition Bill was passed in the House of Lords. On the 22nd of February in 1807, it passed the second reading in the House of Commons. A new generation of statesmen, inspired by Wilberforce's tenacious example, had risen up to speak in favor of the bill. The motion to abolish the slave trade was carried by an overwhelming 283 votes against, for abolition, to 16 votes against. I mean, phenomenal. The parliamentarians leapt to the feet with great cheers and gave Wilberforce the greatest ovation ever seen in history. It is not depicted close to as emotional as it was in the film Amazing Grace, which is a generally good film, but it was much more raucous. Never in British history had they seen anything like this. William Wilberforce bent forward in his seat with tears of gratitude streaming down his face. This long crusade of 20 years being crowned with success by Almighty God, they just cheered and gave a standing ovation. Even his opponents gave him a standing ovation. The first clause declared all manner of dealing with trading in the purchase of slaves or the transportation of Africa to West Indies or any other territory is utterly abolished, prohibited, and declared to be unlawful. The second clause declared that any British ship employed in the trade will be confiscated and forfeit to the Crown. For the next 26 years, Wilberforce now worked for the total emancipation of all slaves. So it ended the slave trade, but the next battle was to end slavery itself. In 1809, the British government issued an order in council authorizing British ships to search suspected slave ships, even foreign vessels, on the high seas. In 1810, Parliament made slave trading a felony punishable by 14 years hard labor. Wilberforce also solicited the foreign powers like Tsar Alexander of Russia to help eradicate slavery. Tsar Alexander was a very Christian king and was very supportive. He mobilized 800 petitions with almost 1 million signatures for abolition and compelled the British representative at the Congress of Vienna in 1814 to insist on abolition being included in the international treaty. This was after the defeat of Napoleon, both in Russia and at the Battle of Leipzig. The obstructionism of some nations was swept aside when Napoleon returned from Elba, proclaimed the abolition of the slave trade. No doubt this was Napoleon's bid to win British favor. So, in that, Napoleon failed. But when Louis XVIII was restored by British arms after the Battle of Waterloo, he had no choice but to confirm Napoleon's gift and bow to British pressure. He couldn't find himself to be worse than Napoleon. So, Napoleon making that one bold move of abolishing the slave trade and slavery itself, well, that really helped the British cause dramatically at after the Battle of Waterloo at the Congress of Vienna. So a declaration by the eight powers of Europe, which included Russia and Sweden and Spain and Portugal and Britain, of course, that they would abolish the slave trade as swiftly as possible was annexed to the final treaty signed on 9th of June, 1815. Actually, I'm wrong. Portugal was the one power that did not. All the others did. However, only the Royal Navy seriously attempted to enforce the Congress's decision. Squadrons of British warships patrolled the west coast of Africa to intercept the slave ships and set the captives free. Now Wilberforce fought to the registration of all slaves in British overseas territories with the goal of their eventual emancipation. You register them so that you can know if one dies or is mistreated, they can't just disappear, but they've got to account for them and so on. Individual cases of abuses like whipping of slaves was widely publicized to mobilize public opinion against slavery itself. Slave owners shown to mistreat the slaves were prosecuted. Wilberforce founded the Anti-Slavery Society in 1823 and wrote a new book, Appeal to the Religion, Justice, and Humanity of the Inhabitants of the British Empire on behalf of the Negro slaves in the West Indies. In response, the slave owners mounted the most unprecedented slander campaign to wear him down. But Wilberforce was made of tougher metal. He refused to be diverted from his path. In 1824, Britain passed a bill ranking the slave trading with piracy, punishable by death. In spite of all the opposition, the groundswell of anti-slavery opinion was mobilized, and finally, in 1833, while Wilberforce lay dying, a runner was sent to his house to inform him. His lifetime campaign was now fully successful. By an act of Parliament, all 700,000 slaves in British overseas territories, mostly Jamaica, were set free. Thank God I've lived to witness the day in which England is willing to give £20 million for the abolition of slavery. Within 3 days, he died rejoicing. The fulfillment of his labors was the end of his life. The body of William Wilberforce was buried in Westminster Abbey, where the funeral of the Queen just took place, is this monument, where the memorial states, he was amongst the foremost of those who fixed the character of their times. To warm benevolence, he added the abiding eloquence of a Christian life. A leader in every work of charity, his name will ever be specially identified with those exertions which, by the blessings of God, removed from England the guilt of the African slave trade and prepared the way for the abolition of slavery in every colony of the empire. He relied, not in vain, on God. But in the process, he was called to endure great verbal abuse, great opposition. He outlived, however, all enmity. Through the merits of Jesus Christ as only Redeemer and Savior, whom in his life and in his writings he had desired to glorify, he shall rise in the resurrection of the just. Now, how's that for? an epitaph. The history of European morals suggests that the unwary, unostentatious, glorious crusade of England against slavery may probably be regarded as amongst the three or four perfectly virtuous pages comprised in the history of nations. Yes, a lot of bad things were done by the British government, no more so than in South Africa in the Anglo-Boer War and the concentration camps and scorched earth. But in their war against slavery, that deserves a standing ovation from the nations of the world. Wilberforce was convinced that Christianity must be allowed to pervade and penetrate every corner of a Christian's existence. He determined to put his faith into action in the political arena, and he persevered for 59 years to outlaw one of the most inhumane and profitable practices of his time. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Wilberforce and his friends were uniquely effective in altering the spirit of the age. John Venn commented on the Clapham community. Their lives spoke far more plainly and convincingly than any words. We saw their patience, their cheerfulness, their generosity, wisdom, and activity daily before us. And we knew and felt that all this was not only the natural expressions of hearts given to the service of God. This is one of the youngsters at the time when William Wilberforce was running this work and testifying later. As William himself often declared, it is not in fact talents in which we are chiefly wanting, but in resolute integrity. The test for every Christian is it morally right? Not is it popular, slightly succeed, that's not the question. Is it right? Wilberforce declared the central test of any country is whether it really believed in and practiced true Christianity. As he declared, one of the supreme political benefits of Christianity is its direct hostility to Christianity. All religions of the world are about how I can reach nirvana or perfection and so on. But Christianity is about deny yourself, forsake yourself, die to self, follow me. And Christianity is love your neighbor as yourself. It's all about do to others you want to be done to yourself. Think of others better than yourself and so on. Christianity is very, very hostile to selfishness. The biggest emphasis in Christianity is not to pander to yourself, but to say no to yourself. This is quite unique in the religions of the world. As our Lord Jesus said, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. His biographer John Pollock in God's Politician observed, Wilberforce would disclaim the credit, but the essentials of his beliefs and of his conscience formed the foundation of the British character for the next two generations at least. He was proof that a man may change his times, although he cannot do it alone. Wilberforce had become the national conscience, and the effect of his actions on succeeding generations was extraordinary. He pioneered a new political integrity in an age of corruption. He transformed the House of Commons from a self-serving club to an assembly concerned for the common good of people worldwide. We need a couple of William Wilberforces in South African Parliament today. In fact, I can think every parliament in the world needs one. I'm sure Zimbabwe needs one. Britain needs, so does America, Ukraine. Wilberforce also had developed new ways of rousing public opinion, such as the pamphlet wars, petitions, graphic prints, local societies, voters' guides, all pioneered by him, and used them to influence Parliament. You can see why William Wilberforce is an inspiration for African Christian action. He also ensured that British foreign policy would have its roots in the biblical principle of love for your neighbour. Most significant of all, Wilberforce transformed his fellow countrymen's attitudes towards Africa and India. He planted in the public conscience not merely a sensitivity against injustice, but a positive sense of obligation to people. Not just sins of commission we avoid, but sins of omission we seek to rectify. We had a joy of helping and producing this book by Bernard Edwards on enforcing abolition at sea. The Royal Navy versus the slave traders in African Christian action is attributed in this book in numbers of cases, and we supply quite a lot of the illustrations. Wilberforce inspired an ideal of trusteeship that was to influence British conduct overseas for at least another century. The abolition of slavery was one of the great turning points in history. If slavery had not been abolished before the Great Scramble for Africa, then Africa would have become one great slave farm so enormous that it was corrupted and it would have destroyed Europe itself as surely as slavery and corruption conquered the Roman Empire, destroyed the Roman Empire because it was rotten from within. Wilberforce's obedience to the Bible was graciously used by God to bring freedom and life to millions. The abolition of the slave trade and slavery itself removed a monumental obstacle to missionary outreaches in Africa, because as long as slaving continued, it was very difficult, if not impossible, for missionaries to even get into the interior of Africa without considering foreigners as a threat to their life and liberty, let alone to gather a congregation amidst the understandable suspicion of foreigners and the fear of being captured by slave raiding tribes. And so William Wilberforce and his co-workers helped prepare the way for the 19th century to become the greatest century for missionary advance. And the song Amazing Grace is forever associated with this enterprise of ending slave trade. May God raise up a new generation of reformers in the tradition of Wilberforce for the 21st century. Leviticus 25 verse 10, proclaim liberty throughout the land. Any questions and comments? I might say this lecture is one of the chapters in the Great Ascension Missions book. Any questions, comments, observations? I would like all of our politicians to read a biography on William Wilberforce.
I think it's very inspiring also in view of the pro-life mission that we do. You know, that you've got to persevere. You've got to put up with opposition. And let's do what the Lord wants you to do and not what people want you to do.
I see a tremendous parallel. Battle against slavery in the 19th century, battle against abortion in the 20th and 21st century. Howard? Yeah,
just to narrate that was very inspiring. I would love to stand up and cheer while you were presenting it.
Yeah, well, I feel like standing up and cheering as well, because that's what Wilberforce really achieved. And I mean, I thought this is a good presentation for today, because this Sunday we make a stand for life. And the life chains, by the way, are international. Since 1987 in America and since 1992 in South Africa. So for 30 years in South Africa, we've been holding life chains every year. And there can be 1,400 life chains stretched across 70 countries with 1 million participants on the average life chain Sunday. So it's a wonderful thing. It's not just a Cape Town thing. This is an international event. And so it's a wonderful, it's always the first Sunday in October. And we know of Durban, Doctors for Life's organizing a life chain there. We know Kempton Park. So let's pray for them. And I know everywhere from Canada, Zambia, Australia, New Zealand. I mean, there's a lot of life chains around the world. So we can be part of something international. And there is the, we are registered also in the International Life Chain website of the Cape Town event too. Any other comments, observations? How many of you have seen the film Amazing Grace? The one on William Wolf? Oh, most people have. I mean, it's a good film, but I must say I've got one major complaint about it. And that is the first scene is, it starts off with a horse being whipped, and it's a distressing scene, but it's also inaccurate in that William Wilberforce in the film only sort of stands and says, if you let it rest, it should probably be able to recover. So some very lame comment, which is not William Wilberforce in the slightest. His grandson said he saw his grandfather, William Wilberforce, get out of a carriage when the man was whipping his horse, take the whip out of the man's hand and whip the man who was whipping the horse. He said he would never have just stood by while a man was being cruel to an animal and just give him a slight verbal slight. He said that wasn't his grandfather would whip anyone whipping a horse. He said he would not tolerate cruelty to animals. He's the founder of the society, Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, RSPCA. So I thought that was a shockingly disgusting beginning to what was otherwise a good film. To have a person being so lame in the presence of animal cruelty, that's not William Wilberforce. I don't know what the filmmakers were thinking in including such a horrendous distortion of history as that. But the rest of the film's good. So if I showed that film, I'd edit that out, because I think that's just like, it's not true to his character, it's not true to history. That the man would think that you just sort of stand by and make some idle comment while the man continues to whip a horse. Just, that's not what he would do. Neither would I. I know we've got other people here who love horses. Anyone else got comments, observations?
Just the people being removed from something enables them also to gloss over it, like abortion and slavery, because most people didn't ever see, lay eyes on, you know, in England, a person in their house, had never seen actually what happened on a slave ship. You know, visually, they comprehended it. They very easily clam up when they go, when they hear, oh, it might affect your economy, right? These kind of things that, but if you and same with abortion, if you present them with the real horrors of things, changes people quickly. So yes. don't hold back on the horror stories.
I think that's why many pro-lifers around the world have gone on to even using the horror shock pictures of actual abortions, what an aborted baby looks like. This is not a product of conception. This is not a termination of pregnancy. This is not a blob of tissue. This is a human being. I mean, look, and so I personally use the shock tactics of atrocity pictures very, in a limited way, very cautiously, because I don't want to harden people either. But sometimes you've got to expose people to the reality of what you're dealing with. In my earlier years, I'm afraid I probably used a few too many pictures of people murdered and blown up by landmines and things like this to expose the evils of communism. But then I realized that you mustn't overdo it. There's a fine line. You don't want to be exploitative or to dull people's senses, which Hollywood often is doing. They throw people so much that after a while people get fairly casual about things that they should be horrified about, like blasphemy and murder. So there is a place for showing people pictures of this is what slavery is, this is what abortion is. Yes?
Oh, I wanted to comment that I like the idea where they were preparing for the freedom of slaves before it actually happened, where they made that settlement in America to help the slaves before it actually happened.
That is so true. I didn't give any real emphasis to that, but that is significant. That unlike the Americans, they didn't have a war over this, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people die, and then in the end, the slaves are left worse off than when they were employed with homes and food. These people planned ahead so much that they had worked out, we've got to train them, give them skills, money's got to be put in, you've got to compensate the slave owners who had invested, and which was a key way of avoiding a war. Imagine if the American government had offered to buy out the slaves and set them free. They could have saved themselves billions of dollars. The destruction involved and 650,000 lives in the American war between the states, but they didn't want to pay out the investments of the farmers who would have been economically ruined. And so in the end, they paid billions and billions of dollars in war and absolute shocking chaos caused. Britain managed to have a settlement where the slaves left the employment of their masters with skills and with clothes and with tools. I mean, they'd really thought this out. They'd put a lot of effort in. And the result was that the gainful employment, they even had a place for those who wanted to settle back in Africa, Sierra Leone and so on. And so there was great forethought. These people thought of everything. And I think also the pro-life movement has also matured from just protesting abortion is wrong to adoption-loving option, crisis pregnancy centers, unwed mothers' homes, adoption agencies. You could see there's lots of looking at solutions. I mean, this is Christianity. We don't just condemn the other side. We've got to try to condemn the practice without condemning the people, and we've got to look for redemption. So, for example, you just take Philemon, the book of Philemon, one of the shortest books in the Bible, where Paul does not damn to hell Philemon for owning a slave. But he appeals to him to receive him back as a brother and if there's anything that he owes you, presumably the slave has fled and stolen something, put it to my account, I will repay. And you can just see it's a masterful of like an iron fist and a velvet glove. There's tactics, there's appealing to his better nature, but there's kind of almost threats there too. But Philemon is a wonderful example of how to bring about the abolition of slavery, such as was done by Wilberforce, thinking ahead, instead of just the way that the abolition in America did, where they were supporting John Brown terrorism. I mean, as John Brown's body lays smoldering in the grave, that whole mentality, it was really, you know, vengeance, and we're going to destroy, and we're going to tread the winepress of the fury and there's going to be rivers of blood. And the whole mentality of the North in American war between states, it guaranteed that, in fact, those slaves were worse off afterwards than they had been before. And that's the way the world often goes about things. So we've got to be a lot more intelligent than that. I think the pro-life movement has matured and is very constructive, very much focused on redeeming people. You know, you think of the amount of people from Christian homes who thought they had to go for abortion because they could never be forgiven the scandal of an unwed pregnancy. To the point where, but the life is more important. We don't want you to think you've got to kill a baby in order to save the rest of your life and that the church will never accept you. There's been a focus on redemption. There's a lot more intelligence and also people adopting has become far more popular. And I know people have adopted 5 children and so on. Just there's amazing ministries that the pro-life movement's brought out some of the best in the church. And I think that there's so much between the abolitionist movement and the fight against abortion today that I see that more and more pro-lifers are calling themselves abolitionists, particularly in America. I don't know if you've noticed that. Because the abolitionists in the past always understood abolishing slavery. But today the term is being adopted more by the pro-lifers that we are abolitionists, we seek to abolish abortion. And I think that's a good tactic. Any other comments? Well, let me remind you of some other upcoming events, Sites for Life Change coming up. We've got the Reformation Art and Essay Competition due by the 27th of October. And on the 29th of October, Saturday 29th, we have got the Home Education Fair right here. Anyone wanting to put crafts and table things out for food, books, crafts, anything like that, free. Nobody has to pay or rent a table. And then on Reformation Day itself, Monday the 31st of October, we'll do a guided tour for those who haven't been around the new renovated Huguenot Museum. And then at 12 noon, there will be a Reformation celebration service at the Huguenot Monument. We've got a remembrance service coming up on the 6th of November and Biblical Worldview Summit and Great Commission, of course, coming up in the new year as well. So those are some of our upcoming events. And I should also note, I just learned last night that a good friend, Brother Andrew, passed away on Tuesday, 27th, God Smuggler. And Bill Bathman first met him when he was still driving this Blue Beetle and in Bensheim, 1957, in Germany. And he's on his way to Poland and Hungary. And I just sent out a message on Brother Andrew's life and recollections of when I first met him and when Bill Bathman first met him and the different involvements. But there's a lot more we can say about Brother Andrew. Dutch missionary to the communist world, to the persecuted church, smuggling Bibles, good friend of Bill Bathman. We've put his memorial on our website and also sent out by email today.